Picture yourself at a dinner party. The conversation turns to economics. Someone at the table utters the word capitalism. At this moment, a few people are going to take a quick gasp and start holding their breath because, let's face it, capitalism is one of those things that people can get passionate about. Good morning, I'm Gina Kaufman. In his new book, How the Poor Can Save Capitalism, John Hope Bryant doesn't advocate for capitalism, but he doesn't rail against it either. We can refashion and reimagine capitalism as we would have it, he writes, and then do something other than complain about it. Stay tuned for that conversation after this news. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today it's my pleasure to be speaking with thinker and entrepreneur John Hope Bryant, CEO of Operation Hope. Frankly, this particular guest has too many claims to fame to list succinctly. Among other things, he was appointed by Barack Obama to serve on the President's Advisory Council on Financial Capability for Young Americans. We've invited him to join us today to talk about his recent book, How the Poor Can Save Capitalism, Rebuilding the Path to the Middle Class. But first, let's learn a little bit more about Mr. John Hope Bryant himself. Hi, John.
Hello. Nice to be with you.
Nice to be with you, too. Tell us a little bit about your background. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in South Central Los Angeles and Compton, California in my early years. Mother worked as a seamstress for McDonnell Douglas Aircraft, which then became Boeing Aircraft. And my dad owned his own business for 54 years. And they divorced when I was very young, around five or so. My brother was growing up my hero. I wanted to be just like him. He's still my hero.
Oh, that's
and
nice.
For different reasons. My sister was my shero and protected me growing up. I was the youngest, now treated in many ways like the oldest, which is a whole other story. my mom and dad divorced over money. To bring this sort of back to this topic, we had many assets. We lost them all, except the work that my dad did with his own very own hands with a cement contracting business. And he didn't screw that up because he did it with his own hands. But he did misquote every job. So if the job cost $1,000, he would, and if somebody else was quoting $1,050, he would quote $950 to win the job. So the more money we made, the broker we got. And then the number one cost of divorce in America is money, of course. So my mom and dad divorced over money, and I remember that at a very early age. The good news is, rainbows after storms. My dad gave me a great sense at an early age of who I could be. I didn't know he was financially illiterate at a young age. I just knew he was a great guy who ran a business, and he was my role model. So I'm a businessman because my daddy was, and my mother told me she loved me every day of my life, and I believed it. So I really don't have a big self-esteem problem today, primarily because my mother convinced me I was somebody.
Well, you know, some of the things you've talked about we will be getting back to, but you've hinted at this idea that the financial equation is more than numbers, that it can be something as emotional and sort of profound in your life as the difference between a successful marriage and a marriage that ends up bringing a family apart. Can you talk a little bit more about that, about what the numbers are to you, what money is to you?
Well, we're not human doings, we're human beings. And Deepak Chopra has said, we're not human beings having a spiritual experience, we're spiritual beings having a human experience. What I mean by that is you don't do business with companies or countries, you do business with people. And that's about relationships. And the first relationship you have is with yourself. And so you must love yourself, you must like yourself, you must affirm yourself. And poverty, half of all poverty is low self-esteem. Half of poverty is not believing in yourself.
A lot of people could hear that as saying that that poverty is something that people end up in through a personal shortcoming. And I suspect, based on having read your book, that's not what you're saying.
No, it's either. I mean, we're born perfect. Every child is born perfect, but we get the hope beaten out of us. We get the inspiration, the aspiration. We get the sense that we can do anything beaten out of us, convinced out of us, kicked out of us, disinfluenced, disencouraged out of us, told by those who so-called loved us that we can't do it. We're in an abusive environment. Or in the case of African Americans, it's 300 years of slavery, Jim Crow, and a range of other things that after a while you've been told that you aren't important, you start to believe it. And you have an entire race of people that needs a psychologist because they have a self-esteem problem. There's nothing wrong with them. Zip, zero. Other than they've been lived in a culture where they've been convinced that they're less than. The Native American population has issues with alcohol. I think it's tied to this same issue of self-esteem or the lack thereof. And that goes both ways. You have families that the parents have strong self-esteems. The likelihood the children will be the same. So success builds on success. Failure builds on failure. I'll give you a real practical example of that.
Please do.
Which ties into the second part of poverty, which is role modeling. You think about a neighborhood there somewhere in greater Kansas City where you see rap star where kids who want to be rap stars, athletes, or, God forbid, drug dealers. Now, the natural, rational assumption is these kids are dumb or they're stupid. They're making really bad choices. That's not true. The kids are brilliant. They're actually just modeling what they see.
Well, I want to get...
We're all modeling what we see, and we all are aspirational. And if you don't see business people in your neighborhood or people with suits and ties on, you don't see traditional symbols of success, then you will model what you see.
That makes a whole lot of sense. I want to get back to the arguments of your book very shortly, the book titled How the Poor Can Save Capitalism, Rebuilding the Path to the Middle Class. But a little bit more about you before we get there. You refer in this book to having been given an opportunity through a business internship or role model to change your life. What is the opportunity you're referring to and how did it change your life?
Oh, there were plenty. I mean, there were a half dozen role models, including today. I mean, I call Ambassador Andrew Young, who wrote the foreword in this book, my personal hero. I just saw him this morning. And every time I see him, he just lights me up. And I say, that's who I, in part, want to be.
And that is a beautiful foreword, too.
Yeah, thank you. I take it, although he embarrassed me about being a Soul Train dancer, but former Soul Train dancer. But my first experience that I guess is relevant to this conversation was I was 9 years old. And a banker came in my classroom in Compton, California, to teach a course in financial literacy. It was a home economics course. And I looked at him like he was from Mars. I'd never seen anybody with a suit on, yet alone a white man who looked very prosperous. He wasn't a detective. The only people I saw in my neighborhood with suits on were detectives, and they were bad suits. This was a good suit this guy had on. And I said to him, I said, what do you do for a living? And how did you get rich legally? And I wasn't kidding. I was dead serious.
And you're how old?
I was 9. And he looked at me and he said, I'm a banker and I finance entrepreneurs. I said, I don't know what an entrepreneur is, but I'm going to be one. If you're financing them, I'm going to be one. The next year, I borrowed $40 from my mother, jumping a little bit ahead of the story. But I went to go work at a liquor store to be a box boy. Because he was selling candy, and I thought he was selling the wrong kind of candy. And this banker had got me to look at the world through a different lens. He taught me the language of money, financial literacy. And I irritated the guy who owned the liquor store enough. He said, look, just how do I get you off my back? I said, hire me. He said, great, go work at the counter. I don't want to work at the counter. I want to work as a box boy. He said, that's the worst job here. I said, I know. He hired me. I quit 3 weeks later.
Why did you want to be the box boy?
Because I wanted to do R&D. I wanted to learn where he bought his product, what was wholesale, what was retail, what was his cost, what was his upsell, you know, what product was selling, what was. I found out I was right, by the way. I told this guy he was selling the wrong kind of candy, and he should have listened to me. I was a 10-year-old kid with cavities. And so I quit. He wouldn't listen. Ambassador Young says that men fail for three reasons: arrogance, pride, and greed. And this guy was arrogant. He was presumptuous. And he didn't think a 10-year-old kid had anything to contribute. So I went home, borrowed $40 from my mother, went to Iris Food Store, same place he bought his candy. It was on the side of the box. Opened the neighborhood candy house in my den, made $300 a week at 10 years old.
Nice.
Put the liquor store out of the candy business. Found girls and lost the business, and it was a recurring theme in my life for a long time until I got married. But that changed my life. In a serious note, that experience, 9 and 10 years old, changed my life. I started wearing suits to school. We couldn't afford to buy suits. My mother made these little ugly suits. I got beat up every day going to school wearing these stupid little crushed velvet purple three-piece suits.
Yeah, I was going to say, that doesn't necessarily go over well among peers.
But I was my own person, you know. I mean, at that point, I had the endorphins fired on the right side of my brain about who I could be and what I could do. My mother told me I was somebody and told me she loved me every day of my life, and I believed it. My daddy was a businessman, and I finally connected wearing a suit, that he wore a suit 2 days a week, with his banker wearing a suit, with the banker financing people like my dad. And, no one could discourage me. I didn't even notice all the drama around me from age 10 to age 20. And I had 100 different business ideas, most of which failed. It didn't matter, because it wasn't about becoming a successful businessman. It was becoming a successful person that owned myself. And I learned to take no for vitamins. I've learned that an entrepreneur works 18 hours a day to keep from getting a job. I've learned around it, over, through it, I can get to it. I've learned persistence is more powerful than the greatest degrees. I learned that I have what it takes to succeed, and that no one can make me lose.
Well, now, speaking of success, in your adulthood, you are a prominent businessman and advisor, and you have the ear of some of the most influential people in the world. And a lot of people are successful, not as many as we might hope, which we'll talk about momentarily. But when did your success, your own success, reach this level? Can you pinpoint a moment where things really clicked, or was it more of a gradual progression?
I really think it's June 2nd, 2014. I mean, when this book came out, it was a tipping point for me, because in many ways, I founded Operation Hope 22 years ago. We've helped 2 million people. We've directed $2 billion in private capital to underserved neighborhoods. We raised credit scores 120 points. There's a lot of stuff we do that I think is important.
That is a lot of stuff.
But I didn't think it was enough. I mean, poverty was outrunning our ability to solve it. It sounds impressive, but over 20 years, it really isn't. I mean, the problem was outrunning our ability to create solutions, and it wasn't scalable. I was getting very frustrated. This book, when it came out, it felt like, finally, I've done something that has transformational power. I've packed all of my knowledge and so-called wisdom and experiences into a manual, a memo, a memorandum, a manifesto on changing your life that has solutions attached to it. And, you know, voila.
Well,
I'm with you here today, and I'm taking this conversation around the country. I'm not being hyperbolic here.
I really believe that in
all of my years, it's led to this moment, that the book, along with the work on the ground of Project 5117, which at some point in this conversation we'll maybe get to, which is transforming lives at scale.
You can go ahead and explain it now, and then we'll get right to your book.
Yeah. So Project 5117 goes through 2020. It will attack 100 of America's most important cities, and cities within your state, of course. And we will do two things. We're going to create the nation's first and only national network of 2,000 Hope Business in a Box Academies, a network of business academies for young people in public schools that will connect education with aspiration. I think the kids are dropping out of high school because they don't think education is relevant to their future. It's real simple. If we treat the kids like customers, then 30%, that's the best number we got, by the way, 30 to 70% of all of our kids are rejecting the product. They're dropping out of school in the richest country in the world. That doesn't say something about the kid. That says something that the product is not delivering on its promise. And so we're going to give kids a course in financial literacy, language of money, course in entrepreneurship, which is really about leadership and perseverance, course in values, dignity, 25 businesses you can start for $500 or less. We're going to do a pitch event in the kids' auditorium. Think Shark Tank for kids. And when the kids win, we're going to fund the business up to $500.
That's cool.
Give them a business role model, yes. let Gallup measure their strengths on the front end and then measure their output through the Gallup Hope Index on the back end, so we know what success looks like. And I think you just will just crush the dropout rate. Then, so that's 5 million kids to make smart cool, so kids want to stay in school. 1 million kids going through Hope Business in the Box academies.
Well,
then 1,000 Hope Inside locations. These are the bank branches. We're inside of bank branches, credit unions, grocery stores, big box retailers. A private banker for the working poor, the struggling class, and the teetering middle class who make $50,000 a year or less. That's our plan.
Well, we will be following that with a lot of enthusiasm, looking forward to seeing how that all unfolds. But now let's turn back to the book, How the Poor Can Save Capitalism, Rebuilding the Path to the Middle Class. Can you lay out for us in a nutshell the primary argument of your book?
I guess it's two primary arguments. Well, three. Number one, we never got the memo. Those who make $50,000 a year or less in this country, which is half of this country's population, which is about class and not race. You do a class, you get race for free. We're making the wrong argument. We're arguing about the wrong thing. We shouldn't even be arguing, but if we're going to argue about the right things. Color today is not black, white, red, brown, or yellow. It's green, U.S. currency. We're all in this mess together. We never got the memo.
What memo are you talking about?
Yeah, March 3rd, 1865. President Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation before this. Everybody knows the story about him freeing the slaves. Nobody seems to know on March 3rd, 1865, he signed the Freedmen's Bureau Act, and the Freedmen's Bureau Act, you know, was to create the Freedmen's Bank, and the Freedmen's Bank's mission was to teach free slaves about money. Lincoln thought the most important thing he could do, the most important thing he could do after giving people physical freedom, was to teach them about the free enterprise system and how capitalism worked. He was killed 2 weeks later. So the bank fell in disrepair. And to tell you how important the bank was, he put it right across the street from the White House, right across, catty corner from the White House, across from the U.S. Treasury Department. If you're familiar with Washington, D.C., it's now the Bank of America location across from Treasury Department, still there. But that piece of history has been lost, and so with it, the lesson. So financial literacy is no nice to have. Lincoln thought in order to engage in freedom, you need self-determination. In order to self-determine yourself in a free enterprise system, you got to understand the system works. That's number one. Number two, the poor are already saving capitalism. And I'm not going to give you the long answer here, but that's pretty provocative to say that. And we need, and you know, 70% of this economy is driven by consumer spending. It's you and me going to lunch. It's you and the one you love going to dinner. It's paying car notes and rent payments and utility payments. It's going to movies. It's not big things. There's a lot of microtransactions that are the largest retailer in the world is Walmart. Okay, the automobile industry, the cell phone industry. I mean, all these industries were originally products that were designed for the wealthy and the well-to-do. But it wasn't until the least of these God's children got a hold of these products and commoditized them that shareholder value went through the roof. So we need to be supporting and encouraging anybody who's working class. These people need to get a medal. We need to be taking care of their children. We need to give them daycare, let them go to work, and then let them go and contribute to the economy, because anybody making $50,000 a year or less is taking 90% of their paycheck and putting it back into the economy because they can afford not to.
You're doing something very interesting here. So they're driving
the largest economy on the planet.
Yeah, very early in this book, you talk about the 99, not the 99% or the 1%. You talk about making it the 100%. But what you just said right now really does turn on its head something that people have seen as this sort of tragic scenario where, like, we are part of the 99%. And it almost sounds like you're turning that around into something powerful. Like, no, we are the 99%. You know what I'm
Amen.
Saying?
Yes.
It's a really interesting thing.
Life is the way you see it. Is a glass of water is filled to the halfway mark? Is it half empty or is it half full? Well, it depends who's looking at the glass. Whether you believe you can or you believe you can't, you're right. I mean, America's not a country, Gina. She's an idea. And we can reimagine her to be anything we want. But if we decide that she's done, if we decide that she's failed, if we decide the middle class is failing, if we decide that China's already won, you know, this thing about China, you know, beating us, this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life. 25 years ago, we said the same thing about Japan. Japan is done. Japan's going to take us over. They're buying everything. Everybody's going to learn Japanese. Well, you should learn Japanese anyway. But, I mean, it was done out of fear. And then some little kids who didn't read these memos and didn't read all these cynical papers and didn't read the reports saying that we're done already, who weren't looking at negative economics from the past, but looking at behavioral economics for the future, created Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and Google and all of the YouTube and all these things we take for granted. But these kids, created $10 trillion in GDP, right? You know, just put it out of nowhere. And America surged again. And now America's a $17 trillion GDP country, and China's a $5 or $6 trillion GDP country, and Japan is. And, you know, China's got some real problems that they got to work out inside of China. And there's a lot of complications about their model. God bless them. I wish them all the success in the world. But America really does have a special sauce. It's called freedom.
Well, you know, you state in the book that you're not an economist, and you say, you know, I'm not going to be writing as an economist, and that, mm-hmm. you know, your writing is very clearly not in an academic or it's not in that language that we're used to reading about these kinds of subjects. But how do economists tend to respond to the arguments you're making, kind of going against the grain?
Completely silently.
I mean, really?
I'm stunned. Yeah, the book is a bestseller. It came out June 2nd, and it cleared out Amazon in 2 days, and is now a bestseller on business lists, the Amazon list, and iBooks. And I've been on, I don't know, 40, 50 interviews. And Bloomberg Business Week has endorsed it. All these folks. I've not heard a peep from one legitimate critic. When I say a legitimate critic, I mean, I've done some interviews, and somebody will obviously say, I hate capitalism. Capitalism is evil. Da, 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 da. We should just throw away with it and be with it. You know, I get this stuff. And I love those comments. Hopefully we can cover
sure.
that on this call. Let me just tell you what I tell them right now. I just say, look, capitalism is a horrible system, just like democracy. It's a horrible system, except for every other system.
So in other words, it beats the alternatives.
By a long shot. Even communist countries are adopting capitalism. But let me back to your question. I mean, maybe it's coming. I thought that I'd get a firewall of criticism because I am rejecting, basically, and challenging 50 years of long-held beliefs.
And a lot of definitions.
Poverty.
Yes.
And definitions.
Including the definition of poverty.
Yeah. Poverty itself. I mean, if you make $50,000 a year, you've got too much month at the end of your money. I mean, you feel poor. And if you've gone through this global economic crisis, you've seen your neighbors lose their job. You might have seen your dad lose his job. I mean, your self-esteem might be in the toilet. Your confidence might be in the toilet with it. And if your confidence and self-esteem is in the toilet, you are poor. And if you're struggling from paycheck to paycheck, and you're arguing with your wife or husband over money, and you have become dispirited, as Andrew Young would say, be skeptical, John. That's healthy. But don't be cynical. Because when you're cynical, you've lost hope. And the most dangerous person in the world is a person with no hope. So if the elements of poverty can apply to anybody, low self-esteem, crappy role models, crappy environment, you hang around 9 broke people, I guarantee you'll be the 10th. Low aspirations, code word for hope.
So this is your definition of poverty. And I
yes.
noticed that there is not a number in that definition.
Correct the mundo.
Well,
I mean, the government's job, the government should put a number on it. I mean, they should, for a lot of reasons, need to put a number on it. But if you're going to then try to solve it based on that number, you're wrong before you start. I mean, if poverty was rational, the people wouldn't be poor. It's by its very nature, poverty is an irrational state.
Yeah, well, so this usually, so the government tends to define a poverty level by a number that involves some combination of income level, mouths to feed, and the cost of living. Mm-hmm. And you
yes.
define poverty with more sort of abstract and emotional concepts. Can you quickly list those once again?
I think that by my definition is a radical movement of common sense, by the way. This is just common sense. If you don't believe in yourself in the morning, if you don't know who you are in the morning, by dinner time, somebody's going to tell you. I mean, if you don't have confidence in yourself, you are toast in the United States of America and maybe anywhere else in the world. You and I can't even have this interview, Gina,
mm-hmm.
without confidence on both sides. I have to have confidence to say what I believe. You have to have confidence to push back and make sure you're asking the right questions. If you were mealy mouse and didn't have confidence in believing what you say, you couldn't even have this conversation. Your producer couldn't have had the conversation with me before this. Your career would be your career wouldn't be a career. It'd be something in your dreams without you pushing it forward. So half of success is belief in yourself, self-confidence, self-esteem. That's half. Then the second part is role modeling and environment. The book, The Tipping Point, Malcolm Gladwell, University of Illinois study, proved that at 5% role models, every community stabilizes. 5%, just 5%. Why am I a businessman? My daddy was. Why are you in broadcasting? I don't even know your story. I know your story. you saw a lady somewhere or a man, but probably a lady somewhere in broadcasting, and you said, wow, I can do that. That's everybody's story. That's not my story. It's not yours. That's everybody's story. And environment, if your neighborhood is environment's crappy, if your family environment is crappy, if your community environment's crappy, then your own environment's going to be crappy. You know, there's not a welfare mother in this country, in her right mind, that does not want her child to be successful, hardworking, and taxpaying, if for no other reason than to feel proud of them. But you can't give what you don't have. In a blind town, a one-eyed man's king, if you don't know better, hello, you can't do better. People, out of love, pass down bad habits from generation to generation. This is the conflict. Out of love, we tend to pass down bad habits from generation to generation because we don't know any better. And we think because we love you, it's enough. It's not enough. And so the third part of poverty is aspiration, code word for hope. The most dangerous person in the world is a person with no hope. And opportunity. Let's talk about school. If I don't see any opportunity on the back end of school, crossing the line of aspiration, why am I in school? Because I want either a good job or a shot at economic opportunity. If I don't think that my school is speaking to a future aspiration of opportunity in my life, then I see all these kids, you know, rap stars, athletes, drug dealers, gangbangers, seemingly getting short-term shots of success without any school. You know, the hopeless short-term thinker says, let me leave school and go do that. Okay. And they don't have any role models to counterbalance that. They're showing them a different path. And so we end up making dumb sexy over a decade, over a generation. We've dumbed down and celebrated it. And now we've got to make smart sexy again.
You're listening to a conversation with John Hope Bryant, author of How the Poor Can Save Capitalism on Central Standard. We're going to take a short break. When we get back, we'll continue this conversation. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with John Hope Bryant, author of How the Poor Can Save Capitalism, Rebuilding the Path to the Middle Class. John was in town recently to give a talk at the Kansas City Public Library, and that's when we spoke. Someone you keep bringing up in this story is your father, a hardworking man with a successful business, but without, as you explain in the book, financial literacy. And he got plenty of customers, but never really made money. And that kind of seems to tie in with what I'm hearing you say about people with maybe some short-term advantages to gain, but no long-term true financial stability or footing.
Well, he made money, just didn't build any wealth. It's a big difference.
Can you tell the story of your father and sort of unpack that?
Yeah, so, and at some point, I've got to go deeper into the generations before him. But the story is not an uncommon story. It came from the South. Education was not really encouraged. You're encouraged. Your emotional vulnerability was not encouraged if you were a man in the South. And so he was taught to keep his mouth shut or his ears shut, his mouth open, selling something, mostly himself. If he had to get through the door, push through the door through his force of personality, nothing he couldn't do. And now that verbose got him a certain distance. But there's a difference between business and busyness. At a certain point, you can't fake it anymore. And when he got into a business where he was the only employee, okay, maybe that works. But when you had 50 employees on different jobs, you better understand a balance sheet. You better understand economics. You better understand if your outflow exceeds your inflow, then your overhead will be your downfall. You better understand how to bid a job. And my dad never got a professional accountant in his business. Go ahead.
And now you see financial literacy as a civil rights issue.
Oh, God, yes. I mean, imagine driving down the freeway with your family and friends, and you've got all your family members in your car, and you got all these 8,000 pound vehicles around you. Nobody's got a driver's license. Nobody went to driver's ed. And people driving down the street at 80 miles an hour in these basically dynamite bins of 8,000, 5,000 pounds. And your family's at risk. That's what we're doing to the economy. Everybody's just winging it. I mean, we don't teach financial literacy in school. We don't make it a priority. But we live in a capitalist democracy. Now, what kind of irony is that? We live in a democracy rooted in capitalism and free enterprise. 92% of all jobs are from the private sector in this country. 8% of jobs come from government. We don't even know where jobs come from. I'll give you some numbers before we finish that'll just blow you away about where jobs come from. And I'd be willing to do a little non-financial bet that, that most of your listeners can't guess where jobs come from because we've been given either no facts or bad facts. And there's some really simple things we can do to turn this around. But you got to give people the memo. And that's what Lincoln was trying to do in 1865. Give a generation a memo on how free enterprise and capitalism works.
I do want to talk about financial literacy a little bit more because maybe things have changed since I was in school, but I had actually really great access to opportunity, a good education, lots of role models for career success. But even still, I did not have much financial education. In fact, I often hear financial terms that I only vaguely understand. Is finance a part of curriculum anywhere these days? I mean, on the level of, say, dissecting a frog, which very few people are going to have to do later, but everyone is going to have to handle money.
No, I mean, look, it's really, I can't tell you how bad this is. The answer is no. Okay, you've got some states that have mandated it, but look, we got President Bush. My advice and counsel to presidents is bipartisan because I think that money is this issue we're talking about is a nonpartisan issue. And Bush, God bless him, signed his executive order making financial literacy federal policy. Even though he signed the executive order, it still is not mandated in schools. 10 years later. And the number one cause of divorce is money. Last time I guessed, teachers were married. So now even if you mandate it, you don't have teachers who have the capacity to teach it because they're financially literate maybe themselves. And then once you get that under your hat, if you want to put a kid to sleep, give them a traditional financial literacy course. So you've got to connect the right brain of aspiration and hope and opportunity to the left brain of the analytics of financial literacy. If you start talking to somebody about a 401k plan, they just go to sleep on you. Nobody wants to hear about a mortgage, huh?
I would be among those probably falling asleep, as important as I know it is.
So that's one of the reasons I think the book is resonating with people, is that we've made this topic interesting, if not sexy. I mean, we've opened it up, made it open source, demystified it, delivered a memo to people that the nation I don't think has ever gotten about how does this system really work? How do you make it work for you versus having it run over you? And I think that it's a holistic approach is what I'm saying. You got to bring the left brain, analytics, in with the right brain, which is aspiration, hope, opportunity, role models. You got to connect education with aspiration, which is what we don't want a mortgage. We don't want to talk about we don't go to bed dreaming about a 20% interest subprime mortgage. We want to become a homeowner, maybe too badly. Nobody wants a car loan. Nobody dreams about a car loan. They want a cool car. Kids don't want to be told to eat their vegetables. Yes, it's about they don't want lectures. Nobody wants to be told how to don't smoke. I mean, this very, very fascinating thing how the people start not smoking. It wasn't the government saying don't smoke. The side of the box for cigarettes says this stuff will kill you. It says it right there. That's not enough. It was only when people start seeing that educated, college educated, aspirational, successful people didn't smoke. That's when it shifted.
You bring up something interesting that is also a key part of your book, which is explaining that for any movement for change to be successful, there has to be something that movement is for and not just something it's against. And you kind of set up a studying contrast between the Montgomery bus boycott and the Occupy Wall Street movement. I wonder if you can lay that sort of studying contrast out for us.
Yeah. You're the first person, by the way, in 50 interviews in a month to raise that. So God bless you. That's really smart. Because it's an important difference. My friends in Occupy Wall Street had a moment. It was a brilliant moment, and the nation was listening, and everybody would be buying whatever it is that they were selling in that moment. But I'm only angry with them because they were only angry. They had only decided what they were against. They actually hadn't decided what they were for. And this is an aspirational nation. I mean, we are a nation of dreamers, and we create nothing, something from whole cloth. Everything in this country was created by somebody with an idea. We're the country with the largest number of patents in the world, and all a patent is a monetized idea. We're idea freaks. But they didn't have any ideas other than this is a crappy system. But even that was a default because, I mean, a defect because, okay, you say, okay, you came here to picket. Where'd you get the picketing signs from? Well, you got it from a small business. Okay, you know that's free enterprise and capitalism. Okay, well, where'd you stay last night? We roomed in an apartment together. Okay, you know that's probably owned by somebody with an investor with a mortgage on the unit. You know that you're paying rent to somebody. Okay, you know that's free enterprise. Oh, well, you know, how'd you get your car note? Okay, I mean, a car. You know, there was a car note in that car. Okay. I mean, so unless you want to move to the Sudan, or Haiti, you're in the system of free enterprise and capitalism. So if you're going to be run out of town, get in front of the crowd, make like a parade. Take the system that's imperfect, because there is no perfect in the world, and make it better. And so this was the Montgomery bus boycott. This was Dr. King's movement. It was an aspirational movement. Dr. King was a positive person. He was about what he was for, not what he was against. He was about bringing everybody together. He said, this is an imperfect world. What did he say about the movement? It's about saving black men's bodies and white men's souls. He says, I'm here to redeem the soul of America from the triple evils of war, racism, and poverty. By the way, he didn't even talk about black people. He said, I'm here to save black people. He said, I'm here to save America. We're all in this mess together. He was the only black leader talking to white America. And he would march for several weeks until he realized that the economy had stopped in those little towns. And then he would tell Andrew Young, my hero, mentor, the Ford writer in this book, go in those small towns, meet behind closed doors. This is an important part here, Gina. Behind closed doors with 100 business leaders in every town, and then wait for them to cut a deal and then let them off the hook. Give them a gracious way out. Talk without being offensive. Listen without being defensive. But always leave even your adversary with their dignity. Because if you don't, they'll spend the rest of their life trying to make you miserable. It becomes personal.
Hey, could you talk a little bit more about Andrew Young? Because you've mentioned him a few times, and maybe some of our listeners aren't familiar with his story. And tell us a little bit about your relationship with him.
I mean, he was basically the civil rights movement is, it just frustrates me. When people say, oh, that was a black movement. No, no, it wasn't. It was the third American Revolution. No, you had a revolution of independence from Britain. Then you had the independence of oneness, which was the Civil War. And then you had an independence of consciousness, which was freedom and, you know, deciding that we were going to be a country that was for all people versus for only some people, which then, of course, made us the nation where we're the only nation in the world where every race of people with us today within our borders, and which made us the largest economy in the world. All those things are connected. Well, Ambassador Andrew Young, who went on to become an ambassador, a mayor, a co-chairman of the Olympic Games in Atlanta, and he lives here in Atlanta today, 100 honorary doctorate degrees. He was Dr. King's consigliere, his right hand. But he was a co-founder in this movement, a partner in this movement in the sense that Dr. King was a visible piece. We all know his role. But Dr. King never wanted Andrew Young arrested. Not once. He said, Andy, you do me no good in jail. I need you negotiating with these business leaders because you can talk to them in their language without giving up our values. And you can talk to them in a way that's gracious and graceful and allow them a dignified way out. And we don't do that enough today. We don't give people a dignified way out, even when they're lighting themselves on fire, even when they are saying the stupidest thing on the planet. You know, President Reagan was a racist. No, he wasn't a racist. Oh, he's a racist. No, he wasn't a racist. I knew President. No, he's a racist. Look, let me explain something to you. Reagan didn't know no black people. Didn't hang around no black people, wasn't related to no black people. He don't hate you. He ain't thinking about you. It's worse. It's radical indifference. So you've got to build a relationship with Reagan. You got to build a relationship with Bush. You got to build a relationship with Obama. We've never had a president we liked. I mean, we killed Lincoln, for God's sakes. We killed King. The nation, all of us, we have never really had a president we liked. We like them when they're before they're president. We like them after they're president. We don't like them when they're president, because you can't get everybody to agree on anything. So we have to understand that we can disagree without being disagreeable. That's Andrew Young's brilliance. He's my mentor. He loves talking to difficult people. He loves trying to find a way to build this thing called community.
this idea that what works best for the few will often work best for the many, or vice versa, this idea that we're all kind of in this together. One of the examples you laid out for this is Detroit's automobile industry, that this is what can happen when capitalism focuses on the few wealthiest in the system, believing that that's where its strength lies, and that the earlier stages of that process show us the opposite. So maybe you could walk us through the story of Detroit from your perspective.
Yes, and tying this into the comment, by the way, about marriage, every good marriage is made of constructive friction. So whether it's labor unions and shareholders and management, whether it's a city and its workers, whether in this case it was Henry Ford and his customers, Henry Ford was not the first person to create an automobile. He wasn't the first. In fact, he wasn't even an inventor. He was an innovator. But he was smart enough to look forward where there is no vision of people perish, to figure out what we were for and what would make the world better and him profitable, and get the country to rally behind him as not an auto manufacturer, but a pioneer. And he was smart enough to pay his workers enough to buy the automobiles they were making. And voila, you've had the creation of the modern middle class. That's what started it. And then going one step further, you had blacks who saved Cadillac and by extension GM. The company was losing money hand over fist. They couldn't figure it out. But people around the Great Depression weren't buying Cadillacs. But they sent an investigator in to figure out they should shut the brand down. And the guy came back and said, wait a minute. I see a lot of black people driving around in Cadillacs, but we have a policy of not selling Cadillacs to blacks. Don't get me started on this, but talking about shooting yourself in the foot, talking about crazy. And so he said he found out that blacks were using white straw buyers. You can't make this up. White straw buyers to buy Cadillacs. So
what does
you
that
were
mean, white straw buyers?
Well, they would find a white guy to go buy the car for them. So they had the money. There was a policy at Cadillac. I know this sounds crazy. This is the truth. Cadillac had a policy not to sell Cadillacs to blacks. But so the guy, this German guy who was sent in by the board, figured out that the only people holding Cadillac up were black purchasers who were buying the car through white straw buyers. So they just simply removed the policy that you couldn't sell Cadillacs to blacks, put black people in the showroom to sell these Cadillacs to these black middle class. These were lawyers and doctors and barbers and people who are successful in the black community, because, okay, what racism did was, what discrimination did, and Jim Crow, you know, if you were black and you wanted your hair cut, you had to go to a black barber. If you wanted to go to a dentist, you went to a black dentist because whites wouldn't serve you. So that created wealth, oddly enough, for black professionals, which created a black middle class and black wealth, and that black wealth wanted to show it off and they wanted to buy a Cadillac. Well, they couldn't buy it, so they used white straw buyers. When the policies were changed, boom, sales went through the roof. Blacks literally carried Cadillac from before the Great Depression. Sales soared all the way through really the 80s, when black people discovered Mercedes and switched a lot of their allegiance. But there's so many untold stories that allow people to stand on their own two feet. You don't need sympathy. You don't need handouts. America's story is a great story. We've just bought the hype that we're somehow not able to do it anymore. And I just don't believe that. I think we just need to go back to what made this country great. Some of these stories we're talking about. We need to be back in that working class family. We need to be back in the working poor, back in the struggling in a teetering middle class, giving them tax incentives and investment incentives and helping them to raise their credit score, helping them rich people need poor people if only to stay rich.
Well, hold that thought, because if you're just tuning in, you are listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Gina Kaufman, talking with John Hope Bryant, author of How the Poor Can Save Capitalism, Rebuilding the Path to the Middle Class. And you talked about how the wealthy need the poor, and the way that you talk about the poor actually is so different from how a lot of people do. You write, in fact, Hope, you write about hope made real through a pathway to the middle class. And you go on to explain this requires an opportunity and an allowance for everyone to become a stakeholder in a dream, not a creditor to the dream, not a supplicant usurper or bottom fisher to the dream, but a stakeholder, a participant, a partner in that dream. Could you talk about the distinction you're making there?
Sure. To put this as bluntly as I can, if you're not a stakeholder and you're not eating no steak, you don't pay taxes because you have nothing to pay taxes on, and you don't vote because you don't have anything to vote for. So a poor neighborhood literally is a neighborhood without stakeholders, without taxpayers, and without voters. And I think that a poor neighborhood is really an emerging market. In fact, most poor, so-called poor urban neighborhoods in America were once solid middle-class neighborhoods. In fact, Compton, California, where I grew up, it was a black neighborhood, now it's turning into a Latino neighborhood, was not only solid middle-class, bedroom community, mainstream. President Bush and his father lived there in 1953. I mean, you know, you can't make this stuff up. In most inner city, we're so ridiculous in the U.S., and I say this lovingly now. We so obsess about, in the past, race and other unimportant things that my wealthy, well-to-do friends, including some of my black friends, got up and moved out of the central city, moved an hour outside of town to the suburbs. Now they're fighting traffic 2 hours in and 2 hours back, okay, with zapping their quality of life. Yet you got real estate that's central to downtown, in L.A., beaches, airports, ports. I mean, this is in France, they call that city Paris. In France, an inner city is called Paris. In the U.K., it's called London. Only in America do we abandon inner cities, centrally located real estate, and put poor people there.
And
that's, by the way, changing. Here's my prediction. You will see in the next 5 to 10 years, inner cities be reclaimed because people are beginning to realize it's centrally located real estate, and it's also an opportunity for quality of life. We're going to abandon this silly issue of race as a defining factor, and we're going to start realizing the color is green.
You talk a lot about the entrepreneur and the innovator and their role, and that seems to kind of be something that offsets this issue of jobs in decline. You know, the number of jobs in the world being far outpaced by the size of the population of the world. And so is the argument here that these entrepreneurs and innovators, when they create businesses, they also bolster jobs, create more jobs?
Jobs is the whole ballgame. Period. And jobs don't come from where they used to come from. Two alarming ahas. In 1970, jobs came basically from big business. Today, by the way, 8% of jobs come from government and 92% of jobs come from the private sector. That's not the aha. Here's the aha. 1970, most jobs came from big business. 4% from one company, AT&T. Today, 70% of all jobs come from businesses with 500 employees or less. Half of all jobs come from businesses with 100 employees or less. Look around your radio station. Look around the parent company. There's probably somewhere between 100 and 500 people. Go to your hair salon. Go to your dentist. Go to your architect office. Go to your lawyer's office. Go to your medical office. Go to your local doctor. You know, 5 people, 10 people, 8 people. Go to the restaurant that you love, 12 people. You know, it's all around us. We pay no attention to it. There's only 974 businesses that employ 10,000 people or more. And you can name them. I mean, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, Google, blah, 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 IBM. You can name them. And so we're telling all our kids, go to school K-12. Great. Get a degree. Great. Go to college. Great. Get $200,000 worth of student loan debt. No, don't do that. and then go work for a big company or big government who's not hiring. Meanwhile, all job growth comes from startups, shoot-ups, entrepreneurs, and small business owners in year 3 through year 5. That's it. That's where jobs come from. We're looking for love in all the wrong places. We're digging in the wrong holes. Here's the biggest, the second aha. In 1978, we started measuring startups and failures. There, every year since then, it's been about, give or take, 400,000 startups, businesses, births, and 350,000 small business deaths. Now, Gina? In 2011, and the census has not released the new numbers, and they think they're worse. But 2011, first year, you have more small business deaths than small business births. You've got 350,000 births and 400,000 deaths. That's it.
Okay? What do you think
we don't turn that around.
That?
Excuse me?
What do you think accounts for that?
We're looking for love in all the wrong places. We've lost our storyline. We somehow have bought the hype that, I mean, it's almost like we're not living in the real world. We're living in the world of people, of what the media or somebody has told us is the real world. I mean, people believe that China is the largest economy in the world. I mean, we are still the largest economy in the world. We're being racked by fear. And versus focusing on what we're for, we get obsessed with what we're against. We sit here and get in these petty arguments about things that don't matter, about things that don't count, about things that aren't happening anymore. Versus getting on with the thing that we're good at, which is creating things that people want to buy, and then helping people who create those things to be successful, so we can get a share of that thing. If you can't be the entrepreneur, work with the entrepreneur. But all we need is a million startups a year. You save America, you employ everybody who needs a job, and you drive America into another decade of economic prosperity. You cannot be a military leader in the world if you're not an economic leader. You cannot be a philanthropic leader as a country in the world unless you're an economic leader. So all this stuff, you know, you cannot be a world leader unless you're an economic. You've never had a global leader that was not first and foremost an economic leader. I'm not talking about a nice to have. I'm talking about a must do. And 30 million kids, fourth grade through 12th grade in public school, that's the bench strength for the playoff games of the rest of our lives. That we need to sound an emergency alarm. Everybody needs to be offering a business role model. This is what you can do. Don't wait for the president to do it. Don't wait for the senator or your mayor to do it. Everybody listening to this, offer some kid a business role model to come and work in your radio station, your library, your gas station, your cleaners, your small business, your school. Get them a stipend and put a little suit and tie on. Let them dream about who they can be and connect education with aspiration. If you don't have some place for them to work, go put on a suit yourself and go in the school and be a role model inside the school so the kids can see who they want to be.
That is sadly all the time we have for this conversation. But it's been fascinating hearing about all of the untapped potential of our country and our cities. And it's been a conversation with John Hope Bryant, author of How the Poor Can Save Capitalism, Rebuilding the Path to the Middle Class. Thanks so much, John. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you today and a privilege.
God bless you. Thank you so much.
To listen back to today's conversation with John Hope Bryant, or to enjoy any of our previous shows, just go to kcur.org/centralstandard. Sign up for our podcast while you're there, and don't forget to follow us on Twitter, @KCURCST. Tomorrow, we're going fishing. Our guests will help you figure out where to toss a line and reel in some dinner. That's tomorrow at 10 on Central Standard. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's it for today. Stick around for Up to Date next.